Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Today's episode is part of the Special Election 2020 series on the President's Inbox. Each week between now and the Iowa caucuses, I'm sitting down with two experts with different views on how the United States should deal with the foreign policy challenges it faces. We hope that the contending views will give you a fuller understanding of what the candidates are and aren't saying on the campaign trail. This week's topic is remaking U.S. immigration policy. With me to discuss what a sensible immigration policy would look like are Edward Alden and James Carafano. Ted is the Bernard L. Schwartz Senior Fellow at CFR, specializing in U.S. economic competitiveness, trade, and immigration policy. He is also the Ross Distinguished Visiting Professor at the Western Washington University. His books include The Closing of the American Border, Terrorism, Immigration, and Security Since 9/11. Ted, thank you for joining us.
Great to be here with you, Jim. Thanks very much.
Jim Carafano is the Vice President for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Before joining Heritage in 2003, he served in the U.S. Army, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. Jim served on the Trump administration's presidential transition team, leading the State Department and foreign policy transition effort. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Ted and I have done this gig before. I'm not sure we're going to be radically different.
Well, we'll be just enough different to make it fun.
Interesting.
Well, where we agree, we can agree. And where we disagree, Let's explore the reasons for the differences. What I'd like to do sort of in the beginning, Ted, if you could, sort of do a primer, a backgrounder for us on immigration policy. It seems to have lots of constituent parts. How should people think about it?
I mean, I think there are kind of two elements to it. I think the big picture is immigration policy determines who comes and gets to live permanently in the United States, who can move here, establish their life, eventually become a citizen if they want to. So the U.S. government has to establish criteria that determine these are the people we want and these are the people we don't want, and then enforce those criteria. The second part of it, which often gets wrapped up with immigration policies, temporary entry of all sorts. Visa policy for people who want to come here as tourists or students or business travelers. It's not immigration per se, but most of the people who cross our borders are here for that. They're not coming to live permanently. They're just coming here temporarily. So I'd say those are the two big components of immigration policy. And the kind of challenge is, how do you enforce the system effectively? How do you actually have security at your borders and know who's coming and going? And what's the mix of people that you want to come and live here permanently? How does that serve American interests? And there are very, very lively debates over what those criteria ought to be.
Okay, well, let's plunge into those debates. And Jim, let me begin with you. How would you assess current U.S. immigration policy, particularly along the southern border, which has really been the issue gripping political debate in recent years?
Well, first of all, I already agree with Ted. I mean, I think one of the important things when you talk about immigration and border security policy is to recognize there are many, many different various components: legal immigration, non-immigration status, border security, also a lot of our Western Hem policy. I mean, a lot of what we're doing with Latin America and Mexico is integral to that. It impacts on trade issues, certainly impacts on border security, impacts on public safety, not just along the border communities, but across the country. And there's a huge transnational criminal element. I mean, transnational cartels traffic in people and money and drugs and guns, and they don't really differentiate between that. So it is a super bigger than a breadbox issue. To me, the thing that's most interesting is, because Ted and I have been doing this a really long time, is how the nature of this debate has really evolved over time. We had a huge reform in the 60s. We had in the 80s a huge structural reform under Ronald Reagan. We had some adjustments in the 90s. And then in many ways, the whole issue of immigration and border security was almost a political third rail. I mean, it was just something that it was not a frequent conversation in the halls of Congress and the Republic, because we just didn't talk about it. And because it really wasn't a Republican-Democrat issue, it was really kind of a regional issue. Depending where you were, you had different views on immigration and border security. New York, California, big immigrant communities, farming communities in Iowa, states completely different. What's been remarkable is this really came back on the table because of 9/11, I think, is an issue. Since then, we've been grappling with all the issues, and it's, I think, become increasingly a partisan issue as opposed to a public policy debate. It's become a partisan debate where it almost seems that the two sides are going to opposite corners just so they can have dramatically different policies. So the answer to your question is, you know, what are our policies today? And the answer is it doesn't matter, because we're about to have, I think, one of the most Manichaean elections on border and immigration security. And depending on how things shape shape up, you could see policy dramatically shift in one direction or another because they're coming at this from almost two completely different corners.
I take your point, Jim, about the partisanship, the tribalism that's infected immigration policy, but I would say not just immigration policy.
Oh, yeah.
But I guess what I'm really hoping to do sort of in our conversation here is to sort of help people who don't want to think in party terms or tribal terms, help them sort of make sense of what the challenges are. So well, when I say, you know, border security, sort of how would you describe the challenge?
Well, let me start with one. And it's actually not border, which we all talk about. So when we talk about the least, which is legal immigration reform, which we haven't really reformed fundamentally, I think, since the 1960s. I think that's fair. And the question is how do we decide to rack and stack people who want to migrate to the United States legally for the purpose of permanent residence and naturalization, become U.S. citizens? So there are different contrasting models in the world. There's about a dozen countries or so that are trying to go more towards what's called a point-based system or a merit-based system, where we bring in individuals based on certain characteristics that we think are going to make them more constructive contributors to society, right? Not based necessarily on national origin or even economic status, but looking at a variety of factors. This actually seems to be a trend in the world. I think that's fair, that a lot of countries are looking at doing this. And it's something that you would think for 20 years of immigration debate in the United States, that that would have been part of the national conversation. And it actually hasn't until relatively recently. We're starting to have a serious conversation on that. And remarkably, it's, I think, the one that potentially might be least partisan, but it's gotten totally buried because we've been so busy yelling at each other about other issues. But I think it is arguably one of the most important issues that we'll be facing post-2020.
Okay, I was hoping to end on legal
immigration.
Well, there you go. But we can invert.
Because we don't give it just because we always go there last. And we should. It's a big part of the conversation.
I actually think with this administration, it's right to go there first.
Okay. Yeah. Well, how would you assess current legal immigration policy and sort of the rules that govern who can get into the country?
Yeah, so I think this is a little noticed aspect of what the Trump administration is doing. And I think its effects will be profound. So I think while all of the public focus has been on the border and illegal immigration, this administration has been quietly using administrative tools to try to roll back legal immigration. I mean, the normal level of legal immigration in the United States, people acquiring green cards, has been about 1 million a year.
You say legal immigration, are you talking simply about rules, people that come and stay here, or are you talking about temporary immigration?
Yeah, no, these are people who come to live here permanently. So they acquire green cards, which are the document you need if you want to become a permanent resident.
So we're not talking about farm worker programs or H-1B visa programs?
No, we can talk about all these things. So these are just people coming permanently. Normally, that number's run about 1 million a year. It fell pretty sharply in the financial crisis because there weren't jobs in the United States. 2018, it was down to 200,000. And the Trump administration has quite clearly been using a range of executive authorities, regulations, increases in fees, tightening scrutiny of people who want to come to live in the United States to try to reduce the legal immigration numbers dramatically. This is a big change. Like if you go back to the Bush administration's, Obama administration's, there was essentially a consensus. They differed on particulars a lot, but legal immigration good, illegal immigration bad. Let's figure out how to stop illegal immigration, encourage legal immigration. A lot of division over what to do about the people who are here unauthorized, the, you know, call them the undocumented or illegal immigrants or whatever you want to call them. That was a big difference between the party, but a lot of consensus on that. This administration does not like immigration, period, legal or illegal. And it has been doing everything that it can do to cut the number of legal immigrants. In that sense, we are looking at an immigration policy that has a lot more to do with the United States in the 1920s than it does with anything we've done as a country since the 1960s.
Okay, I have to ask you, Jim, do you accept that characterization of the administration's approach to legal immigration?
I don't. I mean, I think there are people that support the administration that support that view. There's, I think, kind of an economic nationalist view that if we just keep everybody out, there'll be plenty of jobs for Americans. I don't believe that's really the administration's policy. It's particularly unsustainable when you look at our gross economics. I mean, we're below 3.5% unemployment, so we're actually way below full unemployment, and we're still adding jobs. I don't think it's the data is sustainable, the notion that, well, we keep these people out, we'll create more jobs for Americans.
Well, I actually find a lot of economists who would argue that immigration actually stimulates economic growth when we compare it, let's say, to Japan, which historically has been anti-immigration.
Yeah, I think if we want to have a 27-hour show, we can talk about the impact of immigration on macro and microeconomics, because the economists are all over the place. Mm-hmm. I mean, we tried to do this when we were working our big immigration reform plan, and everybody's everywhere, and they kind of beat each other into neutrality, I think. But if you look look fundamentally at where the administration wants to go, and they are interested in legal immigration reform, they have prepped a legal immigration reform package. I think that's the first one I've seen, like I said, since maybe the 1990s. It is a reform, and specifically, they don't touch the number. They don't make a judgment on more or less. They basically say, we want to reform the system. The number will be what the number will be. They may want to clean up some administrative things and everything else. What they do want to move is away from what's often called chain migration or family migration. It's the notion is, are you related to some of the United States that gives you puts you to the front of the line to come here, and opposed to kind of merit-based. In other words, nobody's saying you can't bring your family. So if you immigrate, you know, Ted can bring his wife and kids. That's not what they're talking about. But they're talking about, you know, relatives and cousins and grandparents and stuff like that. They are dealing with some of the, they would say the things that have been neglected, like, well, you're bringing people in. They don't have proof that they have health insurance. They don't have proof that they can, you know, pay for themselves. We're not charging people what we should be doing. So they would argue they're cleaning that up. And you can have different views on this, but I think this is a discussion we really ought to.
To be clear here, though, has the Trump administration formally tabled the plan, sent something over to Capitol Hill?
So no, they have written the plan, and they've gone out and they've actively recruited congressional sponsors. They basically have two major pieces of legislation. One is legal immigration reform. The other looks at border security and internal enforcement. My guess is they will probably introduce those plans this year, not because they think that Congress will pass them, because it most certainly will not, but I think they want to put on the table when people say, well, what are you going to do? They want to put out there, this is what they'll do. And their argument will be, we're hoping going to get a mandate in 2020. And if we come in 2021 and the politics are right in Congress, these are the legislative reforms we put on the table.
I just say I half agree with Jim. I mean, I think he's right. This administration would like to move legal immigration more in a merit-based direction. There's a lot of sense to
like
that.
Like the Canadians have a system
much more like
this,
the Canadians. Most countries do. The Europeans are more like that. The Australians. We have a system that's heavily based on if you're related to a U.S. citizen, then you come up in the queue for when you get into the United States. That makes a lot of sense. There were elements of that in previous immigration proposals. But if you actually run the numbers on what the administration is endorsing, the RAISE Act, which they have endorsed, you run the numbers, would cut legal immigration in the United States about in half. You'd be admitting 500,000 or 600,000 rather than a million. And then Jim mentioned in passing this rule the administration is pushing for called the public charge rule, which would essentially say unless you have an income that's 250% above the poverty level, you're not going to qualify to immigrate to the United States. The Migration Policy Institute has run the numbers on that. And about half of current family-sponsored immigrants would not qualify under the new public charge rule the administration is proposing. So we are talking about significant effects on overall numbers.
I would just add, though, that in fairness, they have not endorsed the RAISE Act. This is a legislation which has been proposed in Congress, which would actually mandatorily require a reduction in numbers. And their bill, which is their bill, not the RAISE Act, doesn't change the numbers.
They have fudged a little more. I'll agree. There's certainly been a lot of noise in the administration supporting the RAISE Act, but I'll agree.
Before we go deeper into this, can I draw you both out? You seem to both be in agreement that moving toward a merit-based Australian-Canadian-style system is a good idea. I just spent the weekend, I was in southern Florida with a lot of people who are immigrants, and I'm not so sure that they would accept your operating principle that limiting family reunification is a good idea.
Well, you're talking about the nuclear family, again, I don't think anybody's going after the nuclear family. Extended relatives, I think, they are going after that. I think it's a question of demographics. If you look at the developed world, their demographics slow. If you want to have people that continue to fuel the economy, grow jobs, pay for the entitlement for people who retire, you've got to keep the demographics up. Now, let's be honest, immigration doesn't solve your demographic challenge. You can't import labor your way out of this, but it's a significant component to it. And immigration is a powerful economic engine in terms of if you bring people here who add value to the economy, they're going to grow jobs. They're going to help grow the economy. There's no question about that. And there are people around the world that have skills that we need and want, and we can't get enough of those guys.
Just think in terms of family, you're right, there would be a lot of resistance. And there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party who have resisted the idea of moving away from a family-based immigration system. The challenge here is you need to find a system that can sustain political support.
Right.
And clearly connecting immigration policy to American economic progress is a good thing to do. And I think there's a fair bit of evidence that systems like the Canadian system really work quite well and are politically more acceptable than a kind of open-ended system that says we're essentially as a country going to kind of abandon control over the admissions process. If you're related to a citizen or green card holder, then you get in. I think Americans are saying we need to have a system where there's a more considered judgment.
I mean, do we have a sense of what the American people think about this?
From having watched this for a long time, as Jim has, I think it's very clear the American people want more control. I think there's a widespread feeling that the immigration system is out of control, both in terms of security at the borders and in terms of oversight over who gets to come and stay. And face it, at the end of the day, it's a rationing process of some sort or another. Any immigration system, we're not going to let in everybody from the world who wants to come in. And so there have to be accepted criteria over who we're going to admit and why. And we haven't really revisited those fundamental questions since 1965, a little bit in the 1990s, but we're way overdue for that conversation.
And I think we really agree on this.
That part we totally agree on, I think. Yeah.
Legalized immigration is about what do Americans want. The Constitution doesn't tell you that. And over the course of our history, we have changed our minds about what we want for a whole bunch of reasons and in various different economic, cultural, all kinds of reasons why we've changed our mind. It's what do American people's, that's why you should revisit these issues, because they are going to change, because the world changes, the demographics change, your country changes. It's not a bad thing to revisit that and have an honest conversation about what makes sense for America. Having said that, there are people, there's this book out, I saw this guy who did the history of Homo sapiens or whatever, you know, basically said, look, there should be a right of global migration. Anybody in the world should move anybody anywhere they want. I can tell you one thing, I don't think most of Americans are in that place.
I would agree with you. I don't think you're going to see people signing up for that as a basis of immigration policy. I do think that it could become politically charged in terms of any effort to limit family.
But that is politically charged. It has been for a long time. Yeah. That was a big issue in both the Bush reform, well, in the 60s, but then in the Bush reform efforts and the Obama reform efforts, there was a lot of resistance to cutting the family category significantly. Yeah. They were cut a bit in both of those proposals, but not in the dramatic way that the Trump administration is
proposing. But here's the difference. It's now toxic. I mean, this is the difference between politics and what we have today.
Yeah.
Today we have kind of incredible toxicity, which is basically, if they're for it, we're against it. We don't care what it is. And these are tough issues in normal times. Immigration is probably, well, there's a reason why it was the third rail in the 90s and 2000. Our economy was growing. We were doing fine. We were the world's lone superpower. Just don't even talk about it. You know, it didn't have to be put on the table. Competition with China, global terrorism. These are things that have put it back on the table. You have to have that difficult conversation. But I think I would fault both sides. I would just not fault the Republicans, and I wouldn't fault President Trump. The political class in Washington, D.C. decided to make this issue toxic, to use it as a wedge issue to drive voters into their corner.
How so?
Because they've gone completely in different directions. You know, we can go to border security. I think it's one of them. The one thing that from 2001 onward that Republicans and Democrats never argued about was securing the border. Now, they had different ideas of how to do that. But literally now, I think you have people would say that we should secure the border, and people who are saying, I think arguably they're saying no. But I think that's one where...
Are you referring to Julian Castro's statement that he would decriminalize entering the country?
I mean, just to be clear, because I think there's a lot of confusion about this. I don't want to see the Democrats going into 2020 running on that, because it's going to be very easily misinterpreted. But the narrow point that the Democrats are making is the reason it was possible for the Trump administration to separate parents from their children at the border when they did so last summer was because crossing the border is crime. And therefore, they could charge the parents with a crime. And once the parents were charged with a crime, you had a rationale to remove them from their children. So I think the Democrat position is, well, if it's not a crime to cross the border, then you can't do that anymore.
I don't know that it's a Democratic position.
Well, most of the Democratic candidates. Most of them have signed on to it. Yeah. And I think, unfortunately, that plays into the divides on both sides, because I think we've moved from a situation where both the Bush and Obama administrations in different ways were serious about securing the border to the point where it really has become a kind of Democrat versus Republican issue. As someone who leans a bit more on the Democratic side, I think that's a terrible place for the Democratic Party to be. And then on the Republican side, Jim can counter if he wants, but I think the tactics of this administration on border security are, you know, out of, you know, 1,000 years ago, right? Wall building and seizing land from Texas landowners, and all of which we know is A, going to be utterly ineffective and isn't going to tackle the real problem, which is asylum seekers coming up from Central America. So I think on both sides, you've got positions that don't begin to solve the very real problem we're facing as a country.
Let's go to the wall first, right? Because, again, there's rhetoric and then there's what they're actually doing. This administration never envisioned building a wall from sea to shining sea. At the end of the day, what they're going to do and what they're trying to do is build about 450 miles of wall, which covers most of the major smuggling routes, which is, if you asked anybody in the past two administrations and they said, how many miles of wall do you really need and where do you want it? You wouldn't have gotten terribly, horribly different numbers. This administration's actually already set aside the money for that and has most of the construction permits. So that arguing about the wall or not, dude, that's done. That's
Jim,
not a 2020
debate. Are you distinguishing
debate.
Between the administration and the president? Because I watched the president's comments pretty carefully, and it seems to me he's conveying he expects a wall.
President wants a big shining wall. From sea to sea.
He doesn't seem to be suggesting.
I think his position's far more radical than that.
I honestly think on that matter, you're exactly wrong. I really do. The president's rhetoric as a politician, oh my God, the fact that presidents have rhetoric as a politician, shocking people, and that rhetoric doesn't necessarily exactly match up with what their policies actually are. That's like unremarkable, like forever. People tend to fixate it on this president because he's a lot more demonstrative in his rhetoric, and I get all that. But the reality is, this administration's looking about 450 miles of wall, and then they're going to be happy. And that 450 probably covers, again, 90% of what really needs to be done.
You've already got more than 650 miles of wall. So that gets you about 1,100 miles of wall if you add that. They're going down into Texas and issuing eminent domain to Texas landowners along the river. They're going to take their land away to build a wall. That's pretty radical stuff.
This is where you and I, we'd have a real conversation because we would never use the word wall. We would say, what border obstacles do you need? If you've got a smuggling route, right, and you want to get some time space delay in order to do interdiction or help with deterrence, what kind of border obstacles would you need? You wouldn't be talking about, a wall from sea to shining sea. And the reality is a lot of what we built before and called a wall really wasn't efficacious for the mission that was there. And so, to be honest, a lot of the wall building that they're doing is just replacing inadequate border obstacles that were already there.
That's what they've done so far. They clearly want to do a lot more. How much is TBD?
They're going to get to 450 and then they're going to be done. And here's the deal. Yeah. That money's already in the pipeline. They've already moved that money. That's appropriated money.
Well, again, not appropriated. It's moved from the Department of Defense under the National Emergency Declaration. That is different than appropriating the money.
Well, no. That money has been appropriated by Congress to be spent. Now, you may not like
that purpose, but
here's the thing. As far as cutting a check from the U.S. government, it's appropriated. Congress has authorized you to spend that money. That's a done deal. Most of those contracts are already let. So in a sense, the Manichaean debate that the Democrats and Republicans are having...
Manichaean meaning good and evil.
Good and evil, right? Build a wall and don't build a wall. That's yesterday's debate because this administration's already put its wall policy in place and it'll actually be done before the next inauguration.
Well, let me just ask this question then, Jim. Assuming you get this wall, which is not the wall that the president has described, this smaller wall, at least in length, what problem will it solve?
Well, walls never solve problems.
Then why are we building one?
Well, because walls are part of solving problems. Why do people put fences around their houses? Because it's like, lock your door. There's a burglar in the neighborhood. Well, the burglar could just come through the window.
But the point is,
you still lock your door. Why do you do that?
Yeah.
Well, because it's cheap and it's efficacious. And this is the problem with the build a wall, not build a wall, and which is a political debate, not a policy debate, because it's about everything you're doing to manage, interdict, deter, deal with it that matters. They're all components. It's like we were having a discussion about World War II and we say, build a tank. Well, what problem does that solve? And the answer is, it doesn't solve the problem. It's just part of the problem.
We're in a different position right now with the wall. You go back to the 1990s when you had, tens of thousands of people crossing from Mexico in very large numbers, building a wall in the key corridors in San Diego, Tijuana, in El Paso, Juarez. That made a big difference, right? That actually
helped bring those were built.
I mean, those have been built. And I absolutely agree with Jim on that front. But the problems we're talking about now are organized smuggling of drugs and people. Those are the people who are least likely to be deterred by a wall because they have lots of ways to get over, around, and under.
We're talking tunnels, mini submarines, and drones, and the rest.
You go down, you talk to Border Patrol there, and any place where they've got fencing, they'll say, there was a tunnel that went from this warehouse to that warehouse that we discovered and was used to smuggle drugs and we're trying to shut down. So it's not very effective going after the smugglers. And then the big problem, which is the one we haven't talked about yet, which has been in the news constantly, is asylum seekers coming up from Central America. And walls are not going to stop those people. Now, the administration has been doing a lot of other things to try to stop those people, but the wall doesn't solve that problem.
So what we have seen is, and again, I wouldn't talk about a wall in isolation no more than I talk about fighting a war and just talking about tanks and nothing else, right? It's kind of a package, and it is interdiction, it is deterrence. And I also would say it is about humanity. This notion about, we're hurting people, stopping people, it's very inhumane, everything else is, the inhumane thing is people have to get on the road to begin with, put their lives at stake, worry about being raped, having dehydration, exposure, all kinds of horrible, and not to mention, you know, some smuggler grabbing you and saying, where's my $10,000, right? You know, this tragic case of the man and the little girl that died. I mean, that happened because a smuggler took all their money. They didn't know that they couldn't just walk in the United States, and they just made a really horrible, bad decision and to just try to swim across. We could have different debates, but the best situation is if that's not happening, right? If the illegal immigration isn't there, because that really puts risk. And so the point about the smugglers is actually really great. So whether you want to say the wall, the migration policies or whatever, part of what we see is dramatic decrease in illegal immigration from Central America, because people realize even if they get here and get across the border, they might not be able to stay. And now they're redoing the calculus. So what's happening? What's really interesting is the smugglers are not getting the flow from Central America that keep the profit levels up. So now they're going to Mexico and looking for people there to try to, you know, boost their numbers up and get the profit back up. So, and this, I think, gets to Ted point where we perfectly agree is, it's not a wall in the sense, you know, a wall is part of a system of migration, right? And you're trying to deal with the challenges that system, and that system is always going to evolve and change and morph and mold. And it's really about a situation that you're constantly changing and adapting your policies to keep up with. It's not about, I put up a wall and I'm done here.
One last question just about the wall issue, because I take your point that Democrats are against the wall. It's part of their overall messaging. But it seems to me Democrats are for border security and have been quite clear they're willing to fund a lot of these things that aren't the wall. And you seem to be telling me that I shouldn't think of the wall as what is being put up there, but smarter obstacles. So is there actually some grounds for agreement here?
No. Look, I mean, when they talk about border technology and everything else, it's about interdiction, right? And if you say, I'm going to put out an array of sensors, I can see these people are coming. Well, okay, you still have to have a border security guy to go and interdict them and stop them. You still have to detain them. And let's be honest, what we've seen is if you don't detain people, the odds of them, you ever getting them out of the country again are like near zero, right? Because once
you... Is that the case? I mean, it seems to me that for the last decade, there have been a fair number of deportations.
No.
Obama was criticized for being deporter-in-chief.
In terms of the aggregate numbers, I think if you get into the country and you stay out of trouble with the law,
right,
your odds of getting deported are still fairly small. They're higher under this administration than they were, because this administration is going after non-criminals as well.
But there's...
If you keep your nose clean, then I think it's true. Your chances once you get in the country. But I worry that we're going to mislead people here. And there's a lot of misunderstanding on this, because we talk about border security as kind of the single thing. And the way we came as a country to think about border security was from the experience of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, when it was largely young Mexicans coming here to work. And they were trying to cross the border. They were trying to evade the Border Patrol. They were trying to get into the country and get a job. And their likelihood of ever getting deported was very small.
And most of them went home.
A lot of them eventually went home. They made money and they went back.
That's one of the great ironies of border security is, before we had a very transitory population, they would sneak in the United States, they'd work, and when the season was over, they'd go home.
The more
border security you built, the more it was like, dude, why should I go home? I gotta get back there.
Yeah, this is a bigger debate. And then they brought their families in with them. Right. But that is not the problem that we're largely facing right now. The numbers coming from Mexico have shrunk quite dramatically, partly
There's
for demographic reasons.
Outflow.
It's a net outflow now if you look. So what we're talking about are people arriving at the border to claim asylum. And this is not a straightforward thing for people to understand. So under U.S. law, under various international conventions, we have committed to, when people arrive at our border and say, I am fleeing persecution, torture, the potential of death, we have to give them a hearing to determine whether they will be allowed to remain in the United States. And so the people coming from Central America, from the Northern Triangle, region where there are very high levels of violence and murder,
are coming to El Salvador, Guatemala,
and
Honduras.
Primarily. And they're arriving at the border, and they're not trying to evade the Border Patrol. They're actually looking for the Border Patrol. And they're coming in, they're saying, I can't go back home. It's dangerous. You got to keep me. And here's the problem that we have not begun to address seriously as a country, which is, there's no question there are people coming from those countries who genuinely ought to be given asylum, are facing kinds of threats that we don't want to send them back home because their lives are in danger. There are also very significant numbers of people who see this as an economic opportunity. These are poor countries. Right. They've got relatives in the United States who can raise the money to finance the smugglers to bring them and their families here. And this is an economic opportunity. And you know, certainly there are lots of good reasons to do that, to better your life, etc. But our asylum laws were not designed to deal with that. And you have this utterly dysfunctional system where if you get past the first hurdle at the border, you're inside the country. And it could be a year, 2 years longer before you're hearing in front of an immigration judge. And then you're effectively here. So I mean, we always talk about the immigration system being broken, but our asylum system is by far the most broken piece. And nothing we're doing right now as a country is dealing with that. The last thing I'll say, and then I'll let you jump. The Trump administration's approach is all deterrence, trying to make it as difficult and dangerous as it possibly can to discourage people from Central America from trying in the first place. I don't believe that meets our humanitarian obligations as a country. And it's also, so far, we'll see what happens going forward, but so far hasn't been very effective. I mean, it was a huge surge of people last summer, despite all the warnings from the administration about the horrible things that were going to happen. And when they got here, people came anyway.
You know, so we agree. I mean, the big problem is what's called meritless claims. So people who maybe want to come here and whatever, but you don't have a right to come here under the asylum process. And part of the humanitarian catastrophe there was when you're faced with a number of 100,000 people, I'm just making this up, you have 100,000 people, say you have 1,000 rightful claims, right? That 1,000 people, they're stuck in a mass of 100,000 people. You can't address and help the truly needy. So that is a bigger, the breadbasket problem. I'd also point out, and the nature problem is changing. Immigration from Latin America is going to begin to slow. It already is beginning to slow because of the demographic. The major next wave of migration in the United States is going to come from Asia. Some of that is already coming up through the southern border. We've seen people from all over the world come through. It's unbelievable, the recruiting networks bringing people from, you wouldn't believe, countries to come across the border. But we throw around different numbers, 40%, 50%, whatever, people come on a legal visa and just overstay, right? That's a big problem.
Those are people who aren't necessarily coming up from the southern border. They're allowed to. So
they're flying here on legal visas here, mostly, or maybe coming from Canada.
And that's what you're saying, 40%, 50% of the problem?
Yeah, that's the estimates.
Yeah, pick a number. And that, of course, with the migration flow from Asia, that's going to become a bigger problem. And of course, that's a bigger than a bread box thing too. So the nature of the border security threat that we're going to see in 10 years is going to be very different from the nature of the border security.
Let me ask you a question, Jim. How do you deal with the visa overstay problem? Where you're allowing people to come in legally, presumably because you want them to be students or you want them to hold a job or you want to have tourism, and then they don't go home. Is that a problem easily fixed?
I mean, the single best and proven solution for that is doping in people who have a propensity to overstay to begin with.
Yeah, but that's presumably what has driven State Department visa consular officers.
So I'll give you an example.
Around the world.
Well, I'll give you an example of that. So, for example, one of the non-immigrant visa programs we have is called the Visa Waiver Program, which is it's a terribly named program. It's not really a waiver. It's a cooperative agreement between the United States and I don't know how many countries now, 27, 28, 39 countries. Essentially is you can come here for 90 days without a visa, travel, business, whatever. We can go there for 90 days.
We're thinking mostly West European countries.
And Japan,
a few others, Korea and a few others. Okay. And the way you get into this program is essentially you have a demonstrable record of that the people in your population that travel to the United States don't overstay. And that's a superlative program, actually has very high security standards. Actually, we know more about a traveler from a visa waiver country, if we need to get information on them, than we do from a country where you have to require to get a visa. So yeah, I mean, the answer is if you bring in people who don't want to abuse the system, because once they're, and I think we would agree on this, is, you know, and I think internal enforcement has to be part of the problem, but you cannot internally force your way out of it in the sense that you cannot run around and arrest everybody, person who's in the country illegally in an efficacious way, and that's your deterrent to illegal immigration. That's just not going to work.
There are simple things you can do that the State Department's only started to do recently, which is, you know, for everybody who comes to the country, you get an email address for them.
Right.
And then, you know, a month before their visa is about to expire, you send them a threatening email saying this is to warn you that your visa's up in a month.
It's sort of like nudging his.
Yeah, you should make provisions to go home. And there's a lot of evidence that if people think they're being watched, they're more likely to do the like that. I mean, the U.S. immigration system was so loose for so many years. Right. I mean, we really were a pretty open country, right? Our first big wave of immigration, if you arrived here and you didn't have tuberculosis, we were going to let you in. You know, we tried to restrict for a while in the 20s and 30s and then opened up again. I think we've never lived as a country with a fairly rigorously enforced immigration system, and the growing pains to try to get there are very, very difficult. And it's been particularly difficult because, you know, getting back to where you started with this, Jim, we don't have a Congress that's been able to reach a consensus on rewriting the laws. And so we're doing these things through administrative tools, which are A, quite crude often, B, based on laws that are antiquated, and C, just not appropriate to the task in many cases. So I think, you know, we're ending up taking a dated system and making it in many ways worse by trying to sort of do administrative workarounds.
No, it's very
Rube
Goldberg.
Getting back to the values question, right? And we get these flip-flops, right? You know, if the Democrats Democrats are in power. They're using the administrative system for, you know, DACA and other things that are legalizing the system.
Yeah.
And when a Republican takes the White House, they're pushing the system hard in the other direction. That is not a good way to run a policy.
Let me give you a simple example. Yeah. Right. And so Rube Goldberg, you guys used to drive these old cartoons, like this wacky contraption. And in fairness to both the Obama and the Trump administrations, they struggled to use the tools that they had because Congress didn't move on this. But USCIS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, I think is an illustrative example. So most of their, I think their operations are virtually completely funded by fees, right?
Yep.
So here's the problem with that. What incentive do you have to provide better service, efficiencies, or anything else? You don't have to go to Congress to get an appropriation. Okay. The money train just keeps coming. And so if you look at USCIS, I mean, they have some of the most incredibly antiquated services and everything else. It's an embarrassment for a 21st century immigration system.
And they're about to double the fees for most services anyway.
Right, yeah.
Well, I want to go back to the issue of asylum, and I want to go back to a point you made at the beginning of our conversation, Jim, which is that immigration policy has to be seen in the context of a much broader set of dynamics. And when I think about sort of the number of people coming out of Central America, the Northern Triangle, trying to get in and claim asylum, what should we be doing to lessen the surge of people coming here? You mentioned deterrence. In essence, make it the process costly and the likelihood of success low enough so people don't come. But is there something we should be doing on the sort of the push side?
Well, I mean, I think this administration is trying to do some of those things in terms of getting information out there saying it's not a good idea to come and everything else. The third party agreement saying, look, if you had a legitimate asylum claim, you should make it in this other country. You know, often people say, well, we need economic reform. Well, of course, that's the classic foreign assistance problem. If they could grow jobs, you know, you wouldn't have had to throw money at them, right? So this administration is very excited about opening up private investment in Latin America, building jobs there, building factories there, saying, you know, we should be doing business here and not in China. That's a bit of a struggle, though, because you've got to get the fundamentals of economic reform, the good governance, the corruption. Like, those are
Things that tend to be missing in places like Guatemala,
Honduras. I think that's also part of the problem. So the other big thing I think is, you know, we have to deal with the criminal networks. I applaud the administration for not moving to designating them as foreign terrorist organizations. That was a bad idea. They're not. And it's a different tool set that you need. So making them FTOs doesn't give you the tool set you need to deal with criminal cartels. It's like we could have declared the mafia a terrorist organization. It actually wouldn't have helped us defeat the mafia better. The tools that we need to defeat the mafia are a different tool set. So I applaud them for not doing that. But it would be great if we could demonstrably take the cartels out of the picture in the human trafficking business. For example, if you go into the intelligence community, which I'm not part of, and I said, what are you collecting against? I can find somebody that's collecting against the Russians and the Chinese. And if you say, well, what are you doing collecting against the cartels? And the answer you would get, well, you know, that's not really a priority for us. We can use our intelligence community to collect against criminal organizations. That's perfectly legit. And the reality is to take down a network, you have to know the network. You have to map the network, right? Then you can figure out drawing up the sources of money, the leadership and everything else. Diminishing those networks, taking the smuggling, you know, stimulant out of the equation, I'd be all for that.
There are two other things I would do. One, I would establish refugee processing facilities closer to these countries. There was a sort of nascent effort at the end of the Obama administration to do that. But you want to do everything you can to discourage people from paying smugglers to take that dangerous trip across Mexico. So you either allow some level of in-country processing if the situation isn't quite that urgent, or if they need to flee the country, you establish basically a refugee camp. And Costa Rica had agreed to do that, where you vet and process these people without having to force them into this dangerous journey. The second thing, which I think is by far the most important, is that we need to completely overhaul our asylum review process. The reason so many people are trying to get here, even though their chances of a successful, positive asylum ruling are fairly low, is they know once they get in, they've got, you know, a year or two or longer when they can live here. And then even if their asylum claim gets rejected, they're probably not going to get tracked down by ICE and deported. So you got to establish an efficient system. I'm not saying it's easy, but we know what the components are. You need more immigration judges. I think you need to tighten the criteria for the initial interview. And the Trump administration has been doing some of this, the credible fear threshold, which is really low. Almost everybody gets in under that, even though a lot of people, their asylum claims get rejected. So you want to tighten that. And then third, and this is probably more controversial, I think that asylum seekers should have a right to counsel because it streamlines the process. You actually have proper legal representation. The notion that people can individually represent themselves in these complex cases. So what you do is you streamline the process. So when people show up, If they have a serious claim, they get a hearing very quickly, and within a month or 6 weeks, there's a ruling, and you detain them for the period of time that the case is being processed. And if they win, they get to come and live in the country. If they lose, they have to go back home. You've got to recreate some kind of integrity in the process. And until you do that, the incentive for people to come, because once they're here, they're likely to be able to stay whether they win the case or not, is going to be overwhelming.
And if I just add to that, the alternative is, let's be a loving country and just take in everybody, right?
But no, you and I agree we can't do that. There may be people who would want to do that. I think we can take a lot more than we're taking.
No,
but
I wouldn't disagree
everybody.
With you. But here's the problem with that is, the American people are the problem with that. The American asylum system, our refugee system, is really, I think historically we've taken in more refugees than anybody.
That's not true anymore, but historically
it was. It was true. Yeah, but I mean, over the course of our history, it is actually a mark of our humanity that we do this. And I think it's a cherished thing. My fear is that it'll get destroyed, because if people just say, well, we'll just take everybody, the American people aren't going to stand for that, and we're going to wind up taking no refugees.
Yeah, though, to be clear, the risk is in the other direction right now. I mean, this administration has reduced the annual number of refugees from 110,000 down to 18,000.
Okay, can I just get
right?
a technical explanation here? So, is refugee policy different than asylum policy?
I mean, the criteria are the same, but the procedure is totally different. Yeah, refugee is someone who's waiting in another country somewhere else, and there's a vetting process that involves the United Nations and then the U.S. government. It's often quite a lengthy one, can take several years. Asylum is this weird kind of loophole that exists in refugee law, which is if you make it to the border of a nation and you say, I fear going back home because I'm going to be persecuted or tortured or murdered, then the receiving country actually has to consider that case and give you a proper hearing there. The criteria are the same, but the procedures are utterly different. And the system as it exists, and this is true in Europe as well. Europe has had major asylum crisis. Right. The system as it exists provides a major incentive for people to take whatever risk they are willing to take, you know, rickety boats across the Mediterranean or smugglers across Mexico to arrive at the border of a country that might take them.
Right. And in theory, you're supposed to do what's called your first safe harbor. In other words, so the first country where you get to where your life is not at risk, that's where you should make your asylum.
This is for refugees.
No, this is asylum seekers.
Asylum seekers, But you make that claim in the first safe harbor you get to. And what we've increasingly seen is kind of asylum shopping, which is, yes, I can make an asylum claim in Tunisia, but I'd really rather be in Sweden, right? The other thing that not to be confused is the process that Ted and I just talked about, asylum, is not about what do we do with DACA recipients? What do we do with people who are here illegally? It's a whole different basket of asylum issues. And I don't know how we're doing on time, but I think this is one of the things where if Ted and I got in a room, you know, I think we would have a typical policy conversation where we would probably agree on 80% of what we need to do, and we probably debate 20%. What we've seen, I think, post 9/11 was the argument was we have to solve the 20% we disagree on before we do any of the 80%. I think we saw, because of the political pressure to both the Obama and the Trump administration, they had to find ways to move the 20% with or without the political support to do that. And if to get back to your what would a sane, rational policy be, I think if you got actually Republicans and Democrats together in a room, the broad consensus could probably sit down and say, you know what, if we take the really controversial stuff off table, we could probably work out about 80% of this. The problem is I don't know if we can get to those kind of politics post-2020. The reality is where we might get to, and either kind of another stalemate and some kind of Rube Goldberg compromise, which really doesn't solve anything, or one side essentially wins a mandate for Republican people and they put their stamp of what we want for immigration.
You know, Jim is talking around this a little bit, but I completely agree with him. And what we're talking about here actually is the issue of amnesty, right? Because I think if you look at what happened in the Congress, in the Bush administration, again, in the Obama administration, they were 80 or 90% of the way there. Yeah. I mean, the 2013 bill got 68 votes in the Senate. And the issue that the Republicans and Democrats could not get passed was what to do about the 11, 12 million undocumented people already here in the United States. And that issue eventually blew it apart. And both sides have gone into these warring camps now. And so, you know, even though you and I might be able to sit down, we'd probably end up in the same place. We'd get 80, 90%, and then we'd disagree over that issue. And what the heck would we do?
Well, then,
right? Would we say, let's move anyway?
Or we're not going to solve the issue right here. But let's talk about this issue of people who are here, whether we're talking specifically about DACA, which is a deferred action on childhood arrival.
It was an administrative amnesty, temporary, right?
In the broader issue of amnesty, since you don't agree, we're not going to solve it here. Yeah. What are the arguments you would make for the position you hold on this issue?
You know, the first thing I would say is not hold up everything else for this public policy debate. Move on the other issues, legal immigration reform, border security, internal enforcement. And this issue I'd say is stop saying we have 11 people here illegally we have to give amnesty to, because we all know that's not true, right? We know that, for example, there's probably a million people who are illegally here and have considered the kind of crimes that nobody would want them to be in the country, right? And you're going to remove them under any circumstances. So why are you even including them in that number, right? There are probably, how you break it down within the existing law, is probably three or four different remedies. You can leave voluntarily. You can have complete relief from deportation. You can have temporary relief from deportation. So there are a number of tools that are already in the toolkit.
I'm not following. What are you doing with the people who are here?
So what I would say is I would have a policy where I would say, okay, let's look at this population and break them up into their logical numbers and then figure out what's the right policy for that group. Because what you might want to do for DACA might not be what you want to do for another group. So for example, I'm sympathetic to the plight of a DACA. You came here as a child, right? Your parents brought you here. Now you're 18 years old. You know, I've been in that country since I was five. What do I do? We're a loving, giving country. I would support a true temporary relief from deportation. So if you came here and you're 18 years old and you have registered with the U.S. government, that the U.S. government giving you a period of time to get your affairs in order, I think that makes perfect sense. Maybe you need 2 or 3 years to finish college and other things, and that's fine. And then
you would still send them back to their country of origin.
As long as you voluntarily agree to go back at the end of that 4-year period to get all your, then that's fine. Here's the other thing I would do that was different. Normally what we have is somebody who enters the country illegally gets a 10-year ban on applying to come back legally. Right. What I would do is if there was somebody in the country illegally, like a DACA recipient who registered when they 18, said, look, I'm going to finish college. When I finish college, I'm going to leave and go back to my country. I want to come back to the United States. And I would say, okay, why would we give you a 10-year ban on applying to come back? Because you have reported yourself, you've complied with the law, you've done good things, why? And you're a good person, you haven't done anything criminal. Why wouldn't we let you come back in? I wouldn't be opposed to you then taking that 10-year ban away, and then you apply like everybody else. And if we had a good merit-based reform system, if you had a good college graduate, they'd probably, you know, have odds of coming back a lot more quickly.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we aren't having sort of these nuanced conversations at all any of this. I guess I would support a fairly broad amnesty for several reasons. Well, I think, you know, you've got people who've been living, working in the United States for a long time. They have American-born children. A lot of them are pretty ingrained in their communities. I think the danger of what happened after the 1980s, when we saw a big surge, if you look at the demographics in Mexico, you look at the economy, I don't think that threat is anywhere near as large as it was back then. And then finally, I think we're not going to get to where we need to be as a country on enforcement unless we deal with this problem. So you think, you know, we talked a bit about interior enforcement, going and arresting and deporting people who are in the country illegally. As long as you've got people who've been here, you know, 15, 20 years, are otherwise law-abiding citizens, people like me are going to say, you know, I don't want to see those people rounded up and deported. But let me just finish on this, Jim. If you actually dealt with that problem, if you had some acceptable outcome in which, you know, and this is what they tried to do in the 2013 bill, some acceptable outcome in which a significant portion of those people were allowed to stay under some status, then you'd kind of wipe the slate clean. And I'd say, yeah, enforce the heck out of it. At the workplace, we want to establish going forward a system that has integrity. When it didn't have integrity, all these people came in. And let's face it, this was as much our fault as a country as it was the fault of the individuals. You know, I worked in our 2008 immigration task force here at CFR with Jeb Bush and Matt McClarty. And one of the members on the task force was the Reverend Richard Land from the Southern Baptist Convention. And the way he always put it is, look, for years at the country, we held up two signs at the border. One said no trespassing and the other said help wanted, right? So you know, we were in good measure responsible as a country for creating the problem of the 11 million. So let's be grown up about it and solve it and move forward.
Yeah, no, well, first of all, I would say, you know, if you've been here in this country 20 years illegally, unless you're a Nazi guard, you know, it's very, the odds of you getting deported are pretty small. So that's,
they are, but that's different than being able to live and
zero.
Work legally
but,
in the
and
country,
that, but
right?
that was not the yeah. amnesty that was offered. The amnesty, they didn't say, okay, somebody that's been here 20 years, they could stay. It was everybody that gets here by the cutoff date gets to stay, which is a replay of 86. And here's the problem.
It was a little more nuanced.
Well, no, it was, but not much. But here's the problem, which is, you know, this goes back to the problem of 86, right? And this is the great.
Just to be clear, to explain 86, it was the Ronald Reagan. Yeah.
So this is the Immigration Reform, you know, Act, IRCA, the Act of 1986, which basically said, look, we'll give amnesty to everybody's back here. You know, we'll clean the slate and then we'll enforce the law. We'll have border security. We'll have temporary workers. We'll do interior enforcement. Everything will be fine. And of course, you know, the unlawful population grew, and a lot of those things we
got the blanket slate wiped clean.
Right.
We didn't get
the temporary worker
and both under Bush and Obama. I mean, essentially the formula was, let's give everybody amnesty and then we'll do all the stuff to fix it. There's very low confidence level in a lot of people that that's a formula that's going to work, that everybody that's here now just gets blanket amnesty and then, you know, we'll start clean. So, I mean, that the formula, just to be clear, it's failed with Republican presidents and Democratic Congresses, Republican presidents and Republican Congresses, Democratic presidents and Democratic Congresses, and Democratic presidents and Republican Congresses. So every possible political combination that's been tried, an amnesty, a big, broad amnesty first solution has failed in 20 years. I don't necessarily go with Einstein's definition of insanity about hitting your head against the wall and expecting a different result. But I think on both sides, they've got to think past about, look, we're not going to do anything, which of course Obama and Trump have already violated, right? You know, we've got to solve the 11 million. If we can't solve the 11 million, we can't address everything else. If that's your formula, I think we're just going to be stuck in a doodle.
I think there does have to be some creative middle ground. I mean, one of the things I've been pushing for a long time is what about allowing people to stay but not have a path to citizenship, except maybe for the younger people who we would want to become full citizens. But if you've been here for a long time, fine, you can stay, you can work, but you're never going to become a citizen. You're not going to vote. That, I think, would take care of some of the Republican concerns that they're all going to vote Democrat when they become citizens. I don't know whether that gets you there, but it seems to me there does need to be something that's a middle ground between allowing, almost all the people to stay and you know, the notion that, you know, we're going to deport half or more.
Yeah, you know, personally, I'm not super crazy about it, the idea that you can permanently live in the United States, but you can never become a citizen. Well, I'm not super crazy about that.
I can see we can go back and forth for quite a long time on these issues. I think we're going to wrap up the President's Inbox for today. I want to thank my guests. They have been Ted Alden, Senior Fellow here at the Council on Foreign Relations, and Jim Carafano, who's Vice President for National Security and Foreign Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Ted, Jim, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
I have posted links to what Ted, Jim, and others have written about immigration policy on my blog, The Water's Edge. You can find the blog at CFR.org. Again, that's The Water's Edge on CFR.org. If you are not already subscribing to the President's Inbox, I hope you would consider doing so. You can subscribe to on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Whichever podcast service you use, I also hope that you would consider leaving us a review as well as your suggestions for what topics to cover. Your feedback helps us improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe Collis also doubled as our recording engineer this week. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This episode of the President's Inbox is made possible in part by a grant from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.